From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Governor Snyder's new budget plan. What's in it? And is he on a collision course with the legislature? We'll break it down for you. Plus, why we need to go beyond carbon neutral.
We have to start sucking CO2 out of the air, and that's what this project is about.
We look at trauma. Exactly what is it?
When this trauma happens, it's like the brain has short-circuited.
Plus, parents sharing those kids' pictures on social media. How much is too much?
Parents have to make a lot of decisions about what is okay to share and not to share, and especially as their kids grow up, how will kids feel about seeing photos of themselves online?
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Climate change is one of the defining issues of our century. It threatens the very existence of humankind. Efforts to combat climate change often focus on reducing emissions of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. But some scientists are saying that isn't enough. Later in the hour, we'll talk with a Michigan scientist about what we can actually do to remove CO2 from the atmosphere. But first, budget season in Lansing is officially underway. Governor Snyder today released his new budget for fiscal year 2018. So let's dig into this $56.3 billion package as we welcome Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta. And from Gongwer News Service, welcome to Zach Gorchow. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
So overall, is this budget spendy or savey, Rick?
Yes. There's something on both sides. That certainly a lot of attention has been paid to paying down debts, including long-term debts, with an eye toward dealing with some retirement costs. The governor is trying to, call a lot of attention to the fact that if he has his way, that the state's budget stabilization fund, its rainy day savings, will hit $1 billion for the first time since the Great Recession. That's still half of what it was before that period of time. But he says that that's a pretty important benchmark, since when he took office, the rainy day fund, if it needed to be rated for that purpose, wouldn't have kept the state operating for 30 minutes. So, there's that on that side. But, he's talking about spending on infrastructure, more money for colleges and universities, community colleges, worker retraining, some bumps for K-12 education, including an additional, basically on top of the usual per pupil grant, some extra money for high school students. So I'd say that there's spending and savings in this.
And Zach, where do you see it on the continuum of spending a lot and saving like mad? Where is he?
I'd say it probably notches a little bit more toward the spending side than the saving side, but not by much. I mean, it really does kind of split the difference. Rick kind of laid out all the ways. I mean, what you don't see here, which is why I put it more on the spending side, is you don't see any like wholesale cuts or anything like that. Now, there probably will be a few items that get phased away, but nothing that's really going to set the capital city on fire and send armies of lobbyists in to try to prevent these things from happening.
Let's dig in a little more with what's in it for education, starting with higher ed. What is the governor offering to higher ed?
There's a $36.6 million increase for the state's 15 public universities if you look at them in total. Now, of course, the decisions are made university by university, and the idea here is to get the sum total of aid to those 15 universities back to where it was in 2011, before the 2011-12 budget, which had a 15% cut. There would still be a few universities that are not totally made whole from that point onward, but it's been a point of priority for the governor since that huge first cut his first year in office, to try to bring them back up to where they were.
And how about K-12?
So this, to me, I think, is the most interesting aspect of the entire budget. There's some really big stuff in here.
And I would say this is the one area that sort of defies the expectation that you just laid out, that we wouldn't see an army of lobbyists coming in to oppose something.
Mm-hmm. So the big news to me was two things. One, Rick mentioned the extra funding per pupil for high school students. We've never done this in the state. It's always been a set per pupil amount, whether you're in first grade or 12th grade. There's always been a feeling, though, especially those in the school community, saying it costs more to educate a high school student than an elementary or middle school student. And no one's ever really disagreed with that. It's just sort of been, well, this is the way we do it, and this is the way it's always going to be.
And this matters in the era of charters.
Sure,
right,
does.
Because most charter schools are K to 5 or K to 8. There are very few charter high schools. So already you're seeing the charter school lobby saying, hey, wait a second. You know, you're going to be pushing more money from the school aid fund into the traditional public schools, and that's not going to go to us.
And they're saying that this violates a principle of education funding in the state, which is that the funding follows the student instead of the funding is based on a facility. And that's why they're pushing back on this, because they see this as the budget in total as taking a slice out of virtual schools, which is something that charter schools have been moving into. And like Zach pointed out, most charters don't operate high schools. And, you know, take on the additional expense that goes with that. And, you know, the budget director said, Al Pasholka said today, well, if they want to, they can get that extra money for high school students, too.
And so, that virtual school piece, that's going to be pretty significant, too. So
yeah.
Not a lot of people, I think, really understand this, but there is a segment of charter schools in the state that are purely online. They are outside of the usual traditional public school realm, but they are operated by charter schools. But they get the same per pupil grant as a regular charter or regular traditional public school. And there have been a lot of people who have said, well, wait a minute. They don't have to pay janitors. They don't have to pay for heating and cooling.
They don't have the bricks and mortar and the support personnel.
And the maintenance.
That, yeah.
Right, that's required. So why should they get less? So the governor's proposing that their foundation grant on a pure pupil basis would drop by 20%. And this is going to be a really interesting battle in the legislature between the charter schools and the traditional schools and the governor on this.
Well, we'll watch for that. Also, Rick, you talked about the tax cuts versus fattening up the rainy day fund. How much does this put him on a collision course with the legislature?
Well, you know, it's tough to say on budget day, because we're still in the period where everybody's talking nice and saying, well, overall, you know, we're good with this. However, especially among the House Republicans, including House Speaker Tom Leonard and Appropriations Chairwoman Laura Cox, they both say that they want to find room in this budget for an income tax rollback. And the governor's response is, I'm open to that discussion, but you need to show me where you will cut or the additional revenue source that you will find in order to make that happen, that it's certainly not going to happen in a vacuum.
And in the Snyder era, which, of course, has been an era where the Republicans have had total control of the legislature, I can't ever remember the governor and his team at a budget presentation trying to preemptively undermine something the legislature was wanting to do. They spent a great deal of time today talking about all of the tax relief or fee relief that has been passed in previous years, but is about to come online. Basically,
for years to come.
For years to come.
Yeah. Okay.
That their numbers are $2.1 billion in tax or fee relief over the next 3 years from decisions that have already happened. So they're clearly laying down a marker that there's no need to pass additional tax relief. We've already got it. And, oh, by the way,
there's more coming.
Yeah, there's more coming. And it's fiscally risky. Those are my words, not theirs, because of all the spending commitments for the general fund in the coming years, namely the road funding.
Wait. Am I sniffing politics here from the governor's side?
Well, from both sides, you know.
That's never been his thing. He's the idea guy, and he puts it out there. But this sounds like
every governor engages in politics. It's just part of the job.
Yeah.
But if we're going to talk about politics, I would say there's politics on both sides of this, since like I said, the Republican leadership in particular is coming in and talking about this, but, you know, not saying where, at this point anyway, you know, they think the money for that ought to come from.
Hey, what's in there for infrastructure, Zach?
So the governor has talked about setting up a separate infrastructure fund to deal especially with things like water infrastructure. So the idea right now is he's proposing $20 million into this fund. And while that sounds like a lot, that is a pittance in terms of the overall need. And the governor would agree.
The number goes into the billions.
Yes. The governor's own infrastructure task force pegged it at a $4 billion annual gap between what the state currently has for infrastructure and what it needs. But I think the governor is hoping to at least just get the ball rolling and start setting aside some funding for this.
Well, he called
the
it
needs
seed
are
money.
Massive. Yeah.
Yeah, just to get it going. How about Flint water? Is there anything specifically new for Flint?
Well, there's another $50 million, $48.8 million to be specific, that goes towards things like cartridge replacement, nutrition programs, because that's considered very important to help kids, you know, ward off some of the effects of lead exposure. But, you know, half that money, $25 million, is just set aside in a reserve fund for whatever comes up during the course of the next fiscal year. And the budget director, Al Pasholka, said that potentially could be a lead pipe replacement if that's identified as a need.
I know there's a lot of other items. There's more money for the Michigan State Police and all. But for both of you, where do you see the biggest potential roadblocks or conflicts for the governor? What's going to have the toughest time getting through? I'll start with you, Zach.
Well, I think this tax piece, tax cut piece, is really the governing item on this whole thing, because the House Republicans are kind of looking with a wayward eye at the proposed increased funding to higher education. I don't think they're really excited about that. You could see the House Republicans saying, well, let's just do less on the higher education side and we can reserve that for a tax cut. That to me, you know, how the tax cut discussion ends is going to be the big debate.
And I don't think if you're one of the class of House Republican freshmen who came in this year that you're going to go back to your constituents and say, well, I got elected in order to take credit for tax cuts passed by earlier legislatures. I mean, that's not going to happen. And I think we could also see a fight between the charters and the administration play out in on the legislative front on that K-12 money.
Thank you so much for walking us through the governor's new budget. Rick Pluta, Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief, and Zach Gorchow from Gangwer News Service. Always great talking with you both. Thank you.
I'm glad to do it.
Thank you.
Coming up, what do kids think about their parents oversharing on social media?
Parents have to make a lot of decisions about what is okay to share and not to share, and especially as their kids grow up, how will kids feel about seeing photos of themselves online?
Then, understanding trauma and its effects. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You know, it wasn't all that long ago when proud parents might carry a small photo album, which they would happily whip out and show off photos of their kids. How quaint that all now sounds. Today, parents have so many options for sharing photos of the kids on social media. One study finds over 90% of new parents upload photos of their children to Facebook. A study in the United Kingdom found parents post nearly 200 photos of their kids under 5 every year. So you think about that. That means by the time a child turns 5, he or she could have at least 1,000 photos of themselves living online. Sarita Shanebeck is an assistant professor at the University of Michigan School of Information. She and her team developed a study exploring a pretty important question. What do kids think about their parents oversharing on social media? Sarita, always good to see you. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Parents might say, well, hey, family and friends, they expect to see photos, and if I don't share them, grandma will. Is that a fair point?
It is, and parents have to make a lot of decisions about what is okay to share and not to share, and especially as their kids grow up, how will kids feel about seeing photos of themselves online that they may have had little control over what was shared and who could see it.
What is it you think parents actually get from sharing those kids' photos?
They get validation, especially newer parents, parents of young babies, which is if you're a new parent and you're saying, am I doing this right? Am I raising them well? Are they healthy? Putting a photo up, even if it's not the original intention, when they put a photo of a baby, it gets lots of likes, lots of comments, and there's validation there. It says you're a good parent, you're a good mother, a good father, and that's supportive, and that's important for parents.
But then, as you say, there are these ramifications that perhaps parents haven't considered.
Sure. Babies certainly can't speak to how they feel about having their photos shared. But as kids grow up, they can. And we did a study with 10 to 17-year-old children and teenagers about how do they feel about their parents sharing about them online, because they are now old enough to be very aware of and conscientious of their online identities.
And certainly, as you say, a one-year-old isn't going to be the least bit squirmy about a photo on Facebook. But boy, a 10-year-old surely can be, and it certainly goes even more for teens. So what did they tell you?
They had a variety of preferences. Some kinds of photos and content are okay to share. So these are generally positive things, things like doing well in school or a soccer game or a nice family vacation, something that shows them in a generally good light, shows the family being fairly happy and content. The things they were opposed to were negative content, bad grades, punishment, performing poorly in some way, family arguments, and they were definitely opposed to embarrassing content. And for younger kids, this might be baby photos. For adolescents, it's girlfriends and boyfriends in their peer group. They don't want parents sharing that stuff about them.
So are you saying don't share the baby photos, or what kind of?
No, interestingly, yeah. So that often is the instinct. When I talk to parents, they say, oh, I share too much. I shouldn't share so much. And we ask kids, how do you feel about that sharing? And they're not opposed to it. So children are okay with their parents sharing about them online, but they want it to be not too often, and they want to have some say over what is shared. And so we ask them about permission. That is, should parents ask permission of their children before they share about them online? And kids say, not all the time, but sometimes. Kids are more likely than parents to say, we would like our parents to ask permission before they share about us, at least some of the time. And the interesting thing is that parents agree. So parents themselves say they should ask permission more often than they actually do.
So they're accepting what the kids are saying.
So they're not totally out of alignment. They both feel like this is not such a bad thing, but let's have a little bit of conversation about what is okay to share or not.
Did you find any differences, Sarita, in views depending on which social media platform is being used?
There are definitely norms. Facebook is, as many have said, now the site for parents and for adults and older people, which actually makes it more okay for families to be connected there and sharing there, because that's the norm. Instagram is more for children's peer groups, and so that's less okay, but also less likely that parents are going to be there. Snapchat is very much a personal, smaller network where kids may have just a few friends. By a few, I mean 30 to 50. Mm. It is not the norm for parents to be in there sharing with that friend group.
Well, I don't think we need to see parents putting like puppy dog faces or kitty cat faces, those weird filters. That does seem to be the world that the kids are inhabiting more than mom and dad, because you're right, the kids have kind of fled from Facebook once we parents got on there. So what do you think parents need to take away from your research, particularly when we're talking about new parents? We'll start with that first.
New parents should be thoughtful about not only what are the privacy and identity implications of sharing about my baby now, but as they grow up, as they are 5 years old and 10 years old and 20 years old, how will they feel about having this online identity crafted throughout their childhood? Will they want control over it? And so it doesn't mean don't share, but it does mean be conscientious about what is okay to share and how will they feel about it in the long run, having this information out there online.
And then as the kids get older, you're saying it's certainly not a bad thing to respect them by saying, hey, do you mind if I post this?
Yeah. And even just asking that a few times will give you a sense of what kinds of things are they typically okay with and not okay with. And then you can try to follow that a little more closely, so you don't have to ask them every time after that, but you'll have a sense of they like this stuff and they don't like that kind of stuff.
What are your thoughts based on the study you've done when you see a parent upload some video of their toddler doing some typically toddler thing, having a meltdown over something? One that comes to mind was somebody, a parent was clearly had the camera on in the back seat, and the little girl was in the back seat and discovered that she was going to have a brother or sister and lost her mind. And of course, it got posted and it went viral and it was everywhere. Should you think twice before you put up that what you think is adorable toddler meltdown video?
A lot of this varies by parents' own preferences about how private and how public they are. Some parents are very private and they don't want anything shared, and some are very public, so they do YouTube videos about their family. And so their child's birth through child development is documented online in the form of video with many, many viewers. And so parents should be thoughtful about where do they fall on that spectrum. There's no one right rule for every parent, but when they disclose things that are particularly sensitive, like meltdowns and tantrums, which are fun. People enjoy it. People relate. And so there's something about that.
We've all been there.
Yeah. Any parent has been there. And so there's some benefits there. You understand it's not just me. There's some sort of socializing that takes place. But as a parent, you want to be just thoughtful about this is out there and it's not going to be removed. And are you okay with that? And some parents will be, and that's okay.
Sarita Shainabak, assistant professor at the U of M School of Information. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. What is trauma? And how do we know whether we're feeling the effects of trauma? What does it take to recover? From refugees forced to walk over dead bodies as children in a war-torn country, to survivors of sexual assault, to job loss and home foreclosure, trauma comes in many forms. As part of our ongoing series, Minding Michigan, we welcome back Michigan State University Assistant Professor of Psychiatry, Dr. Farha Abbasi. Dr. Abbasi, how do you define trauma?
So, Cindy, trauma is acute or chronic adverse experience that really impacts your mind to a point that you are unable to cope up with it. And the inability to cope up with an acute adverse experience, inability to go back to your previous functioning, inability to continue to function, inability to maintain relationships. So it's almost like a shutdown of your brain and your body.
And when you think of the kinds of experiences that you have seen with patients who have suffered trauma or students that you've encountered, what kinds of experiences can inflict trauma?
It's very interesting now. The trauma studies is even talking about that maybe the trauma starts as far back as the fetus can perceive the trauma. So if a mother is going through a traumatic experience, there will be so much stress hormones released in the body that the fetus, it's literally, it's showered with those stress hormones. So even in utero, the changes can happen to the brain of the fetus, to the body of the fetus. But now we are talking about adverse childhood experiences. What happens when the child is continuously exposed to these various traumas? It could be a trauma happening to the parent. It could be a trauma that they are experiencing. It could be a domestic violence, physical, sexual, emotional abuse. It could be just living in a state of poverty. Any state of nutritional deprivation can come as an insult and injury to a growing brain. So even that is a trauma. But then there are situations like you talked about. There could be a loss of a loved one. Divorce can be a trauma. Relationship breaking up is a trauma. Their bullying is a huge trauma. Moving to another country is a trauma. Being in a war-torn area is a trauma. So it's like all these threats that we encounter in our life, most of it you are able to absorb, rationalize, or deal with. And then some people have resiliency to cope with even higher levels of trauma. But anything where your body cannot cope with it anymore, psychologically or physically, that becomes a huge trauma.
So let's just say, a child who is homeless and is having to move around and coping with the stresses at home with a parent or parents who are stressed. It's all kind of under the surface. That child may be acting out in school, but the connection might not be made that that's what's going on.
Absolutely. We, for the longest period of time, has thought of trauma as in physical terms.
Right, like a level one trauma center and auto accidents and off to the emergency room. Yeah.
Where you could see the wounds.
Yes.
Even with the post-traumatic stress disorder and in the war combat zone and what veterans experience, the talk was always about having physically been wounded. even if you look at the awards given in the Army, it's for the physical wounds. And just now the talk has started about psychological trauma, that they should be awarded for the psychological trauma of post-traumatic stress disorder. But what we can see is that, remember, hurt person hurt persons. So somebody who's hurting from inside can indulge in self-hurting behaviors or can indulge in behaviors that can hurt his environment or his relationship or his surroundings.
So can you give us an example of perhaps things you've observed in people's experiences that that could take this form?
Like, let's think of people coming from war-torn areas. And they have seen so much violence, or let's even talk about people who continue to live in this persistent exposure to trauma. Like, let's think of Syria right now. Mm-hmm. Having constantly in the background, you have the sound of bombing happening, drone attacks. I remember when Afghan war was going on, lot of kids would talk about hearing the sounds of Kalashnikov and hiding or shutting down or trying to flee away. So naturally, there are three systems that were given to us as defense in our body, which is fear, fight, and flight. So if we didn't have these three, we wouldn't have survived. The caveman would be standing in front of dinosaur because he wouldn't perceive the danger. But what happens when you are exposed to trauma, these three systems go in hyper alert. So you start associating things which were not actually the actual trauma, but remind you of trauma. So a sound, a smell, a sudden movement, all of that can be triggers. People looking like people when they come back from war, veterans suffering from PTSD, even a familiar, like, looking face or someone talking in a certain way, dressing in a certain way, all can be triggers for that trauma.
Dr. Bassi, how do you treat the effects of trauma? Are there multiple approaches?
I think most important is to understand the full colossal damage trauma does. If something is happening in your mind, it's going to impact your body. And if it's something has happened to your body, it's going to have really terrible impact on your brain. So what we are seeing in trauma is your growth of the brain gets impacted. Your neurons start dying. Your frontal cortex, which is your decision-making area, that shrinks. Your emotional lability increases. You get angry easily. And what happens is then these people put in a stressful situation, they will tend to react more easily. And someone from the outside would say, oh, this person has behavioral issues.
Anger issues.
He's a difficult person. Right now people love to pathologize and label people and say, oh, he's so bipolar. Mm. He's so borderline. We throw these terms out in a very stigmatizing way. So first thing is always remembering, not talking in the language like what is wrong with you, but in terms of what happened to you. That's a big mindset change. Even as a provider, that's something we struggle with, is not to react to the behavior, but to learn to go beyond the behavior and understand what's happening. Other thing is, what is very scary is that we now know that if you look up the Adverse Childhood Experiences Survey, which is a survey of 1 to 10, the higher score you have, the more chances that you would end up with some huge chronic health issues. You can develop diabetes, you can develop hypertension, you can develop heart problems, you can have high cholesterol. On the other hand, you are more prone to develop depression, anxiety, you are more prone to suicidal behaviors, you are more prone to hurt other people, you are more prone to addiction, substance abuse. So I think we need to take a step back and understand a simple thing. Why does someone continue to use a substance like alcohol, opiates, smoking, when they know it's harming them, that they will lose jobs, they would lose relationships, but cannot quit a negative behavior? People who have suffered huge trauma issues, they have big trust deficit. They never feel secure. They have this forbidding of pre-shortened future, like something like my life is going to end soon. So you need to develop an environment of safety, provide them security, develop trust, and long-term therapy. It's a long, tedious process, but we have seen some really positive results.
So, Dr. Abbasi, what should we take away from all of this?
When you are in any setting, Cynthia, be it radio show host, be a provider, whatever capacity you are in, look around at your surroundings and people that you are with. And think of trauma as a heavy bag of bricks. So we collect this trauma from the mother's womb. And it's like every stressful event that we suffer is like putting another brick in our bag. And we are all carrying this heavy burden. So before we assume and make nasty remarks or say or react, we need to take a step back and understand that maybe the other person is carrying a much heavier bag than we realize.
Dr. Farha Abbasi, Michigan State University psychiatrist, thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Still to come, efforts to combat climate change have centered on reducing emissions of carbon dioxide into our atmosphere. But some scientists are saying that is just not enough.
We have to start sucking CO2 out of the air, and that's what this project is about.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Climate scientists have been shouting it from the rooftops for years now. Climate change is the defining issue of our century. It threatens the very existence of humankind. Our efforts to control climate change have centered pretty much on reducing emissions of carbon dioxide into the air. But scientists like my next guest are saying, sorry, everyone, reducing carbon emissions is just not enough. They want to step up efforts to actually remove carbon dioxide that's in our atmosphere, negative emissions. John DiCicco is a research professor at the University of Michigan Energy Institute, and he's been leading the way developing a new initiative called Beyond Carbon Neutral. And yes, we as individuals can play a role in this. John DiCicco, welcome to Stateside.
Great to be here, Cynthia.
So just trying to reduce emissions isn't cutting it.
Well, we're not making progress as fast as we need to, that's for sure. You know, the issue has been discussed for decades. I personally first started working on the climate problem in really 1988, which was when Jim Hansen testified about it before Congress. And that was a wake-up call. And for years, we've been saying, well, to really keep the worst effects of global warming from happening, to keep the atmospheric carbon levels from building up to where we have some kind of runaway global warming, we have to get started soon and begin cutting emissions. Well, I was giving talks about that 30 years ago about ways to cut emissions. I'm an energy expert, and of course, cutting emissions has a lot to do with energy efficiency and then solar energy. I actually got my start in solar energy, and I won't tell you how long ago that was, but we still need to do that. Obviously, cutting emissions is really important, keeping the excess carbon that comes from largely fossil fuel use from going up into the air where the concentration is rising. But at this point, it's clear that's not going to be enough.
Why is that clear?
Because, first of all, we're already at 400 parts per million. We've passed 400 parts per million. So that's 0.04% of our atmosphere is now CO2. Now, that doesn't sound like much. But over the whole period that humans and life as we knew it today evolved over the last half million years, carbon in the atmosphere went between 200 and 300 parts per million. So that's what all our ecosystems are adapted to. That's what we're adapted to. That's what our landscapes and our coastlines are adapted to. and we're already into the danger zone. So it's time to not just redouble our efforts to reduce emissions, but we have to start sucking CO2 out of the air. And that's what this project is about.
So what's involved with the Beyond Carbon Neutral Initiative? So here we are saying, nope, we got to remove it as well as reduce it.
That's right. One of the most important things to keep in mind is nature provides us with some great mechanisms for removing CO2. After all, carbon is the fuel of life. All life is based on carbon chemistry, organic chemistry. That's in chemical terms, that's what organic means, carbon-based. And plants are the primary way that we get carbon from the atmosphere through photosynthesis. The formula is basically plants, sunlight, plus water, plus some nutrients, pull carbon out of the air. That's how forests grow. That's how crops grow. Algae, which can be beneficial in natural settings, but algae blooms, they're sucking CO2 out of the air in Lake Erie. Not a good thing. Natural systems already pull a lot of carbon out of the air on an annual basis, and that's called the global carbon cycle. The global warming problem is because we're putting excess emissions up into the air, largely from fossil fuel burning, also some from tropical deforestation, faster than these natural processes pull it out. So if we can step that up, if we can help nature, and in fact, in some cases, let nature just do its thing, that will be very beneficial. And Michigan is a great place to begin thinking about this.
I'm hearing trees.
You're seeing trees and hearing trees.
Yeah.
And, you know, like the saying goes, let's not lose track of the forest for the trees. But Michigan was largely covered with forest before it was settled and before we chopped the forest down. And initially for timber, it was a big timber state, still a timber state, and now cropland. But throughout the country, our agricultural productivity means we've been able to actually grow enough food to feed ourselves and feed much of the world with less land. And that's a good thing. So cropland is very good at pulling carbon out of the air. Of course, we eat it and it goes back up. So we could let parts of the state begin to reforest. We could manage the forests that we have to help them suck up and park more carbon. And that is probably the most tangible thing we can do pretty much anywhere in the country right now and other parts of the world that were once naturally forested. And it's certainly a great opportunity for the state of Michigan to begin managing its forests in a way that just helps soak up CO2.
And that strikes me as something that individuals who care about this and who think about what the world could be like for their grandkids or their great-grandkids, people can get involved in an effort like this.
That's absolutely right. And I want to talk about one of the projects we've started here at the University of Michigan. The initiative, what we're calling Beyond Carbon Neutral, is interdisciplinary, meaning we've got faculty members and students from all across the university working on different projects related to this. One of the projects that's being carried out at the School of Natural Resources and Environment is working with local forest owners. In Michigan, we don't have big expanses of, say, national forest like some other parts of the country.
Like out west.
Out west. I mean, we have some, but the vast majority of the forest tracts in our state are tracts held by private landowners who, in some cases, are just keeping them. In some cases, they might be doing a little bit of timber harvest for sales or other reasons. A couple of the professors at the School of Natural Resources and Environment, Paige Fisher and Bill Curry, have launched a project to begin talking to local forest owners, private landowners in the state, to learn what their current needs are, talk to them about the opportunities for storing more carbon in their forests and helping the world become a little more beyond carbon neutral that way, and figuring out how, in a very practical way, to make it work for, in this case, ordinary forest owners. So that's a very tangible kind of a project that they just launched. We just launched these projects this past year, and we'll hopefully have some results within less than another year from now.
I'm talking with John DiCicco, a research professor with the University of Michigan Energy Institute, looking at their new initiative called Beyond Carbon Neutral, not just settling for reducing carbon emissions, but actually sucking carbon out of our atmosphere. How do you energize, John, people who will look at
the overall lack of fast progress. Here you say you've been preaching this for 30 years. They see it become a political football and they kind of figure, I don't know, there's nothing I can do. The ship has sailed. And I hear you say, no, the ship has not sailed. We need to get urgent about it. But how do you energize people to realize there is a role they can play?
Well, I think we actually have to start with education in a lot of ways, especially about the opportunities to remove carbon from the air. A lot of people have heard about tree planting as a good thing to do, and that's in a lot of ways what we're talking about here. In some cases, it's not gotten, I would say, the level of attention compared to, say, building windmills, which, you know, is a good thing, obviously, if we can replace more of our coal power with wind power, which is relevant here in Michigan. That's going to reduce emissions. But part of our initiative is going to be educational in that regard, to let people know that here's some things that can be done. And many of these initiatives, especially when it comes to working with forests or grasslands or restoring wetlands is another way to help, are less costly. We tend sometimes to think too much about these big technologies that maybe the utility companies have to do, but they're a little bit less tangible. You can even bring it back to your yard for those of people who have yards in suburban yards. I personally have a bit of property just outside of Ann Arbor in Webster Township. Even before we started this formal initiative Beyond Carbon Neutral, my wife grows the vegetables and I've made it my personal hobby to try to plant trees to restore what was probably an old pasture before the homes got built on it and nurture trees and that kind of a thing. In fact, some other professors also at SNRE at Landscape Architecture looked at the opportunities for sequestering carbon in just suburban landscapes by planting a few trees, by taking better care of your lawn. Things like that are real opportunities for people. And one of the most important things that I like to keep in mind as someone who's worked on energy issues for really just about my whole career is small, tangible steps matter. Sometimes now when we hear about the global climate problem and we hear, say, about the Paris Conference of the Parties and how, you know, the gloom and doom and how much has to be done to save the world, it can be very disempowering. But to get to that, say, 100 million tons of carbon that we might want to reduce or take out of the air, you have to start with 1 ton somewhere else and 2 tons and 10 tons. And that is really how we make progress on any environmental problem, really on any social problem. A good rule of thumb for forests in this area is an acre of well-managed forest land can sequester a ton of carbon per year and do so for 100 years. There's ways to do this that makes sense. And I think we need to educate people about that a lot more. We need to educate policymakers who might be, say, skeptical of some of these other big picture things, but might see tangible benefits for their communities with beyond carbon neutral type projects.
Now, you mentioned this is beyond carbon neutral is an interdisciplinary effort. So what about some of the technical and engineering brains?
Absolutely.
What kinds of things are coming up? Again, as we say, we're talking about actually removing carbon from the atmosphere.
On the engineering side, we have a number of initiatives underway. Some of it starts with very fundamental laboratory work where we have folks looking at catalysts. Those are special chemicals that help make reactions happen more easily. CO2 in the air, it's kind of the end state of combustion and other reactions. When we burn fuels, we release energy, and the end product is CO2. So it takes often a lot of energy to convert that CO2 back into some stable form, some carbon compound. And that's where new catalysts come in. So we have chemical engineers working with things at that level. We also have people looking at how to do this with microbes, bacteria. We're taking kind of a microecological approach to it. A professor at the university by the name of Nina Lin is looking at how communities of microbes can work together and be more effective at pulling CO2 out of the air and converting it into a stable form than perhaps an individual microbe. Let me give another example.
Yeah, give me another. Well, I understand. Is there some kind of concrete being developed that
That was the next thing I was going to talk about.
Yeah.
Yes. Normally, when concrete is made, it ends up releasing CO2. The amount of CO2 from concrete making worldwide is less than 1 billion metric tons of carbon compared to, say, more than $10 billion for fossil fuels, but it's still significant. On the other hand, it's possible to design concretes that pull CO2 out of the air. And that's what Professor Victor Lee is working on. The idea is that he can design these special concretes. We can build buildings out of them, and they will absorb CO2 and do it in such a way that it makes the concrete stronger. So there's some real
win-win, all over the place.
Right. There's some real new creative materials engineering that needs to happen there that he's working on. Again, this is not something like you can go do today, but it's one of the things that we're working on that we believe will be really valuable for the future.
Do you feel like you're racing against the clock?
Of course. I personally, working on this issue, feel like I've been racing against the clock for my whole career. You know, it's hard for me, as someone been working on this, to understate the urgency with which we have to deal with the climate crisis. And yes, that means reducing emissions. I mean, the other part, I work on a variety of projects. I work a lot on vehicle efficiency. That's in a whole other area that's relevant here in Michigan. But the beyond carbon neutral, because these kinds of carbon dioxide removal things have not gotten the attention that some of these other issues have. And also, some of them are not going to be as inherently as controversial, like regulating the auto industry. No industry likes to be regulated. We have to come to some kind of compromises there over and over again. I feel like, given the urgency of climate, this is something where we could be doing a lot more quickly, and engage people very creatively as well.
You can find out more information about the Beyond Carbon Neutral Initiative by going to the website of the University of Michigan Energy Institute, and that's energy.umich.edu. And that's where you will also find out about the seminar series that'll be happening. So anyone who wants to learn more and find out more is welcome to come to, is it a monthly?
Monthly seminars. That's right, Cynthia. In fact, on our website, go to the events portion and you'll see the postings for these seminars. We're going to have one a month throughout the winter term here.
John DiCicco, thank you so much for sharing your work with us on Stateside.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot for your interest.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty.
What?
When?
Why?
I am curious.
Michigan Radio is embarking on another round of Am I Curious? You ask questions, Michigan Radio listeners vote on the one they want us to investigate, and we do exactly that. So it's time for you to vote on the next Am I Curious question. Our digital media director, Mark Brush, is here now to tell us more. Boy, you and the team have really dug into a wide array of topics because of these questions.
Yeah, we've dug into a lot of different things. Everything from were there ever pirates on the Great Lakes to what's the status of the Enbridge pipeline in Lake Michigan.
And so it's really open to anybody's question, and you've got three nominee questions up for a vote. Tell us what they are.
Well, we have one question from Steve Hathaway. He's a high school teacher in Ann Arbor, and he wants to know, could we make the rivers in Michigan in the center of the Lower Peninsula touch so that you could row a canoe from Lake Michigan to Lake Huron?
Interesting.
Yeah, it's a geography project he's always been interested in, and he wants to know if that can happen.
If we're going to have a bike path, we could bike all over Michigan. Why not be able to do
a
rower stuff?
Yeah.
Yes.
And then Tim Patrick from Grand Ledge, he was touched by Rafai Hamo's story. He's the Syrian scientist who had to leave the country after he lost his wife and daughter in a missile attack. He came to Troy, and he's curious how he's doing.
And if I'm not mistaken, was he the gentleman that had stomach cancer and he was in Humans of New York?
That's
and
exactly
everybody
right.
got to know him, and then he landed right in Michigan's backyard. Right,
exactly.
At home in Michigan.
Yeah. So he's just curious with all the refugee talk right now, how's Rafai Hamo doing and his family?
Okay.
And then the last one, Kelly from Monroe, she wants to know, has it really been 50 years since Michigan has had a new tax on beer, and why is that? She had heard a commentary from Jack Lessenberry a few years ago and thought, well, is that true, and why is that? And there seems to be a need, in her opinion, for more tax revenue, and there are a lot of other kind of items, vice items that are taxed heavily. Why not beer?
So people can vote until when? What's the deadline?
Sunday midnight is when we'll close the voting round.
And
so
it's
get
easy
your votes
to do.
In.
So tell everybody how to vote.
So come to MichiganRadio.org, look for the box that says, what should we investigate next, and just cast your vote there.
Very good. Michigan Radio's Mark Brush, as always. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Lise Mesmer, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.